Hi there, Harold. Thanks for coming out, everyone. I just want to say, drink responsibly. I have been all day. So I want to kind of lay out a few things about fracking in Michigan and about energy in general that maybe you know, maybe you don't know. In late in 2011, we saw natural gas prices bottom out at $2 per million BTUs. You might have noticed that your energy bill, your natural gas bill, went way down over several years. Today, the price is just above $4 per million BTUs, about $4.15, chiefly because more power plants are switching from coal to natural gas. Now, compare that back in just back in 2008 when it was $13 per million BTUs. And we all know that gasoline prices are down right now. Crude oil took another plunge because OPEC decided to cut production. But energy is cheaper, and a major contributing factor is the play in shale reserves in North America. We often extract gas and oil through hydraulic fracturing. More importantly, using a new way to use that drilling method, horizontal hydraulic fracturing. I think the two get confused a lot of times. We've been doing hydraulic fracturing in Michigan since the late 1940s. It's only been in the last decade or so that we've been seeing horizontal hydraulic fracturing in this state. Now, because burning natural gas in a power plant, for example, emits about half the CO2 emissions of coal or oil, it means fewer greenhouse gases are emitted. Those are the things that cause climate change. I don't care what you've heard on Fox. It is pretty well decided by it's the major consensus of most scientists. It means families can heat their home more cheaply these days. It means that it's been overall economically a pretty good thing for Michigan and the nation. All good news? No, not really. This extraordinary expansion of natural gas extraction through the use of horizontal hydraulic fracturing is causing real concerns about risks to air quality and to water quality. There have been complaints that very little academic research has been conducted to determine the risk to water supplies. We'll be hearing from an academic about that. The drilling industry says recovering oil and gas is important to the nation's economy and to its security because we're less reliant on Middle Eastern oil. But there are strong arguments to say, well, is this energy source more valuable to society than another resource we have, water? I mean, natural gas is important. So is water, and you have to consider both. So when we're looking at this issue, we have to ask, you know, whether our water supplies can be risked for the sake of cheaper, domestically produced energy without a lot more study. And the short-term energy plan, because after all, we're going to burn this stuff up pretty quickly, and it's going to be gone. We have to still live with whatever water we're left with. And if it's permanently contaminated, that's a problem. Each state and its people will have to decide for that for themselves what kind of regulations they want on this, because Congress has barred the Environmental Protection Agency from safeguarding our water from any ill effects of fracking. And that is puts a lot of pressure on the DEQ. We'll be hearing, if you get to go to the conference tomorrow, from the DEQ about their concerns. I will say, on the positive side, Michigan does have some of the more strict regulations on the casings of a hydraulic fractured well. That's important. In fact, it's becoming a model for the nation. The question is, how safe is safe enough? So, to talk about some of that, this is our panel. First, we'll start on my left. John Colliwert. He's with the University of Michigan at the Graham Sustainability Institute. No relation to this Graham, although I wish.
Take a donation from you.
He has been working on a report that will be released early next year about fracking in Michigan. Next to him is Greg Fogel with Old Mission Energy. He's a petroleum engineer and an advisor on several committees for the state, or at least one at a time, I guess, committees for the state of Michigan. But the state listens to this guy. And James Clift, he's with the Michigan Environmental Council, and he's the one who's twisting arms among the legislators if he can get it through the door. That's the real problem these days. So we're going to talk about this a little bit. I'm going to start with you, John. What do we know about fracking in Michigan? What are the concerns? And can you give us a hint about what your report might reveal?
Sure. Happy to be here with you folks tonight and happy to talk a little bit about what we're doing. And
a little closer. Okay. Kiss the mic. Okay.
And look forward to having a discussion with you, hearing your questions, hearing your ideas about the topic. So I work, as Lester said, at the Graham Sustainability Institute. And one of the sustainability-related research projects that we have underway is looking at high-volume hydraulic fracturing in Michigan. This is one of a range of projects. What we try to do is bring together faculty, students, and folks outside the university to work on challenging sustainability issues. So in addition to hydraulic fracturing, we're also working on climate change for Great Lakes cities, water levels in the Great Lakes Basin, some projects on water and health-related issues in Ghana and Peru. So we work on a range of projects. What we're doing with this project on hydraulic fracturing in Michigan, it's something we've been working on almost for about 3 years now. I don't think it's a surprise to any of you here that you came to this event that, you know, this is a topic that we're hearing a lot about. And it was something that we wanted to see, is there a space for us? Is there something that we can contribute to this topic? And as we looked at it, we felt there was a real opportunity to focus in on what is going on in Michigan and what might be some things that would be useful for Michigan if this activity is going to continue or increase. If you've read anything about this topic, you'll know that a lot depends on what state the activity is occurring in, both because of the regulations, but also because of the geology and the water availability. So it's really a state-by-state issue. What we've done for our work thus far is about a year ago, we released 7 technical reports covering a range of topics from economics to law and policy, hydrology, the whole range of thing to provide that information. And what we're doing right now is pulling all that information together to come up with what we call is an analysis of options. What are some ideas to share with folks in the state, either state government or environmental organizations, industry, about what we've identified as opportunities based on activities in other states that maybe we want to consider in Michigan.
Okay, Greg, I want to ask you before you start. I know that every well is not a fractured well. I wonder how many of the, let's just deal with gas wells. There's something like 11,000 gas wells. What kind of percentage are actually fractured, and what kind of percentage are horizontally fractured? Do we have any of those numbers?
Yeah. First of all, there's, you know, the industry has been active in Michigan for almost 80 years. As you mentioned, we started fracking wells in Michigan in the late 1940s. Of the 11,000 wells that are currently producing gas in the state, around 7,500 are shallow Antrim wells. Of those Antrim wells, mostly located in and around Gaylord, up from coast to coast, but basically around Gaylord, just about 100% of those wells were hydraulically fractured. They were not done with what we call a high-volume hydraulic fracture. They're shallow wells. I'm not going to get into all the technical reasons because that would take a couple of weeks, but of the wells that have been fractured with high-volume techniques, there have been 18. So it's not like it's a huge deal in Michigan so far. The water that's used in a low-volume well is anything under 100,000 gallons of water, which sounds like a lot until you compare it with what's used in industry and farming and these kind of things. The total water used in the state of Michigan by the oil and gas industry is less than 1% of the water used in the state for all the other reasons. So of the 18 that have been done with high-volume hydraulic fracturing, I can't say positively, but I'm pretty sure all 18 used horizontal drilling. Now, horizontal drilling started in Michigan in the 1980s, and horizontal drilling involves you drill down straight for a while, and then at a particular point, wherever your reservoir is, then you kick the well off and go horizontal for anywhere from a couple thousand feet to maybe 2 miles. The only connection between horizontal drilling and high-volume hydraulic fracturing is that the length of the horizontal well, which is long, there's a lot of borehole there, so it takes a lot of fracture treatments, a lot of water, to stimulate that entire well bore. If you drilled all straight holes, you'd have to have about probably 20 to 25 times as many wells. You would do smaller fracture treatments, but overall you would do about the same amount of water and sand and everything else.
So the same amount of water, and you say about 1% of the water that's used in the state is used in fracturing. Now, 1% sounds like a small number until you start thinking about agriculture and power plants are some of the biggest users in the nation. That's still going to be a lot of water, and the difference is that water can't be treated. It's got to be disposed of. It can't be cleaned up. So that's 1% of water that's used in the state that's lost to us forever.
Well, I would argue that point geologically. The water is not lost forever, but it's lost for such a long time, it might as well be forever from the standpoint of where we're at.
I was going to say, if you're talking about a deep injection well, I'm going to call it forever. It's close enough for me.
It's certainly not going to be recovered in my lifetime, but it does not leave the overall water volume in the state of Michigan. It just goes to a different place.
James, your perspective.
Yeah, I guess my perspective is that we've heard a lot about oil and gas drilling happening in this country since the 1930s. And obviously in the last 10 years, technological advancements have vastly changed the nature of this industry. Unfortunately, our regulations, I would argue, are still stuck in the 1930s, that they have not kept track with advancements in the technology. And the technology keeps moving. A little bit of my fear is that someone will figure out, okay, how to regulate today's fracking wells, and it's going to be yesterday's technology. So I try not to, A, differentiate between how we should regulate oil and gas wells and fractured wells. I think our regulation of the oil and gas industry needs to be updated. It needs to recognize today's Cheers. Technology and recognize that we moved a long way. I'll give you one example is that a lot of the things in our law today talk about a 60 or 90 day, you know, blackout where the public doesn't get any information. And these were regulations were based on the fact that, oh, you didn't want to know your competitor where you were drilling for oil or something. Well, with Google Earth, all your competitors know exactly where you're drilling for oil. And you can choose, especially with horizontal fracking, you can choose exactly where that wellhead's going to be, maybe up to a half mile or a mile, and you can kind of get to the resource you're looking for. When you have that much flexibility about where your infrastructure should go, I think that should trigger a conversation with a community that says, where might this infrastructure go that is most consistent with our master plan? So there should really be a much more of a dialogue going today between a community and developers about their, you know, the whole development plan, and doing it in ways that try to minimize environmental impacts. And that's where I think we have a lot of catching up to do.
All right, let's talk about the environmental impact.
Can I interrupt there
for
a second?
Absolutely.
Okay. The first oil and gas rules were written in Michigan in the late 1920s. The first well was drilled in about 1925. The state developed some kind of ad hoc rules from the 1920s until 1939. In 1939, Public Act 61 was enacted, and pretty significant rules were put in place to cover that. Those rules have been amended a number of times, and in 1994, the Natural Resources and Environmental Protection Act was passed, and a lot of rules were amended at that point in time to reflect new technology. I'm sorry, but they were. I'm very familiar with them. Well, the rules have been amended from time to time since then. sometimes they're not amended in a formal rulemaking process immediately. Sometimes they're amended by the supervisor issuing orders or letters of instruction, different things that amend the rules to apply to new techniques. So, for instance, high-volume hydraulic fracturing was first significantly, individually regulated in 2011.
And so how many years after the first horizontal well? 30 years between the first wells and the first significant changes in regulation.
But okay, you're confusing...
Okay. All right.
You are confusing hydraulic fracturing with horizontal drilling, and they are not the same.
Let's
never
back
have
up
been.
Just a little bit, because I think we're getting ahead of a lot of people who are new to this issue. I mean, it sounds scary because we hear reports out of Colorado and Wyoming and Pennsylvania where there have been some real problems. One of the things I want to talk about is when you're using hydraulic fracturing fluid, whether it's high pressure or low pressure, you're basically taking a lot of water, you're mixing it with a lot of chemicals, which include anything from guar gum to kerosene to benzene. It's being forced, that's to suspend the sand, it's being forced down into the shale to hold the shale up, prop it open, the little sand grains open it up enough that gas can escape, and therefore we've got access to this natural gas we didn't before. The fluid is a real concern because it cannot be cleaned up. There are chemicals that are going into it that we don't know about because they're trade secrets by the manufacturers of those fracking fluids. So I want to start with you, John. How important is it for the public, or at least the public to have access if there's a problem, to know what the ingredients of these fracking fluids might be?
Well, there's lots of different ways to look at that. And I think it's important to say that this is an issue that, you know, many states and companies are looking at, too. I believe it was Baker Hughes that has decided they're going to release, disclose all the chemicals that they're going to use. They
right,
were recently
right.
bought. I don't know how that, by Halliburton, I don't know how that's going to play out into the future. But,
right. So
you know,
this is one company of many who make these fracking
Exactly, fuels, so. Exactly. And different states have different approaches to this in terms of when that information is available and how much is available. Michigan is currently has some proposed rules in terms of how that information is shared. The state is proposing that we go to using a national website reporting database called Frac Focus. That a lot of people support that in terms of the transparency and how that shows activity across states. But it also has some concerns about when it's available and who's reporting the information. So
let me stop you just for a second. So if I operate a water purification plant for my local village, how am I supposed to know what to check for to make sure that fracking fluids aren't having any impact on my water sources?
Well, I'll go out on a limb here since we're drinking beer. I'm not certain there's a real connection between what a local water plant facility would be looking for and worried about with how the frack fluid, the flowback fluid, is handled.
Because in Michigan, geologically it's much deeper than...
And in Michigan, it's required by state regulations that is collected, stored in steel tanks, and then deep well injected. It's never stored in an open pond. It's never sent to a municipal treatment facility.
But
which
there's residue
in other
left
states.
In the actual borehole.
Yes.
Right.
So, but that is going to communicate with... With groundwater, it all depends on the well integrity you were talking about in terms of the regulations we have here. The likelihood that fracture is going to migrate up from 10,000 feet to groundwater at 300 feet, a lot of people say that's probably not going to happen. So I don't think the concern is with what's going to happen to a municipal water facility from fracturing occurring. It's if something would happen with the well integrity, maybe with a localized home well, rather than a municipal facility.
So the problem you're saying is not when it's down in there in the borehole. It's so far removed geologically from any water source, it's not a concern. The problem is when you bring it up, when it's above ground, spills are possible. Is the casing sound? So let's talk about the casing, Greg. I've been told that Michigan has one of the more strict casing laws. Explain what a casing is, how far down it goes, and what it's made of. What's it look like?
Okay, the first thing you need to know is that most of the fresh water sources in Michigan are in something called the glacial drift. The glacial drift can be anywhere from a few feet to maybe 12 or 1,300 feet in thickness. So in Michigan, the driller has to set what's called conductor pipe in the beginning. That's usually driven, and that's usually about 100 feet deep.
A steel pipe.
It's a steel pipe. And the purpose of that is just to consolidate or hold back the gravel and the loose rock so that he can start drilling a hole. The first stage of the well then goes down to a minimum of 100 feet below the base of the glacial drift, which is pretty easy to determine by a geologist looking at the samples of the rock coming back. That then there's a steel pipe run down to the bottom of that wellbore, and then cement is pumped down the inside of that steel pipe and comes up the bottom and comes all the way back to the surface. And so you have a cement sheath, generally speaking, about 3 inches in thickness all the way around, and that's on the outside of a piece of pipe that's usually about an inch in thickness. So you've got 4 inches of steel and concrete to protect those shallow zones. Then as you drill down from there, if the well is more than a particular depth, generally it's about 5,000 feet, then another string of steel pipe needs to be put in that hole, and that has to be cemented back to the surface. So now you have two strings, casings of steel, and two cement sheaths to protect those groundwater zones. Then once you get below that, then how much casing you run and how deep it is, that depends on how deep your well is going to be. But it's always cemented in place.
James, that's a lot of concrete and steel. What are you worried about?
I guess I'm going to go back to your first, you know, concept of disclosure. So you got a property owner, and they own the property. They are going to own that property forever. Or they're hopefully going to pass it on to their children. Someone else owns the gas and mineral rights, and they're going to come in and they're going to extract that gas and mineral. So the question is, should they be able to leave behind chemicals and not tell the landowner exactly what's being left behind? In my mind, this is a no-brainer. That landowner has the right to know exactly what chemicals were used in that process, because some of those are going to be left behind in the property. And it might not be 20 years from now, it might not be 40 years from now, but eventually that might leak, and that landowner has the right to know exactly what was used, exactly what might happen in the future. And we're talking a lot about Michigan, where the lucky thing about Michigan is we've got good geological separation between layers. You go down to Pennsylvania, where a lot of our natural gas comes from Pennsylvania, that separation between layers does not exist. So there's a lot of movement between those layers. And I think, you know, we talk about this. I think a state-by-state approach is going to be problematic, A, because that's not where all of our natural gas comes from. So I think there needs to be some national standards that look at a lot of different geologies and think, what basic rights make sense for that property owner going into the future?
But Congress has said that, you know, the US EPA has no business looking into that. It's up to Pennsylvania officials. We're in Michigan.
So let's be leaders. Let's have full disclosure. Let's protect the rights of those landowners. And hopefully that's maybe something that will catch on to these other states.
A couple of other things I want to add on to what's been mentioned before about disclosure and water use. James referenced it in terms of a private landowner. A lot of this activity in Michigan takes place on state land, so there's also arguments or discussions about how much the general public should know about this, not just the landowner, if it's taking place on state lands. And in terms of the water use, again, this is really a state-by-state issue. In Texas and Pennsylvania, there is a substantial amount of recycling of fracturing fluid, where it's reused again in a fracturing process. It's probably not going to be put in, you know, there were some mistakes in Pennsylvania where that fluid was put into municipal water treatment facilities, which should not happen because that's not what they're set up to do. So it's not that type of recycling. I want to just be clear about that, but it's reusing it again, maybe with some additional treatment for another fracturing, fracturing operation. But my understanding of what's going on in Michigan and what the state is trying to promote through their regulations is they would prefer not to do recycling because they'd rather dispose of it in deep well injection sites, so we don't have the issue of surface spills, the potential
for surface
spills.
That's because we have deep injection wells.
We have a capacity for it. Again, Pennsylvania does not. That's why they're shipping it to Ohio.
So, pardon me. I want to talk about the number of wells, which is about 11,000 gas wells, and about, what is it, 5,000, 6,000 more oil wells in this state. And we've got a DEQ who's supposed to monitor all these wells, make sure they're operating correctly, make sure they're drilled correctly. And we have something, we agreed before the meeting that we believe the number of DEQ inspectors for those 16, 17,000 wells statewide is in the 30s. There are like 35, 36 people inspecting thousands of wells in Michigan. And I'm wondering, let's start with you, John. What do you think of that number? And are we safe with that few inspectors and that many wells?
Agency capacity is the way that folks talk about this issue, and that's something that we're looking at with our report. Personally, I don't think it's always a concern to be thinking about. You know, I think part of what is a struggle for me in answering this is we're kind of lumping together all of the oil and gas wells in Michigan and then the high-volume hydraulic fracturing wells. And, you know, there's been a long history of activity in Michigan of oil and gas development, you know, strong regulations recognized by external parties that that's going on. So most of what we're doing is looking at the high volume, the newer activity, and kind of different, you know, separating that from the oil and gas development that has been taking place for decades. You know, as we've looked at it in Michigan and thinking about it from the high volume perspective, you know, there's been very limited additional wells in Michigan because of the high volume activities. It's in the two dozens, 18, you know, some have been completed, some are producing. It's a real range.
Yeah, somebody told me there are only like 10 drilling rigs in the entire state.
It's very limited. There was a lot of interest a couple of years ago. That's all kind of been on hold. You mentioned the low gas price. A lot of people think that's a reason. Could also just be the companies haven't quite seen the return on investment that they're hoping for. But to this issue of, you know, agency capacity, you know, Michigan has been pretty steady in terms of the staffing of the Office of Oil and Gas and Minerals, right? Did I say it right? In terms of about 60 folks, a budget of about $60 million over the past couple of years, and that's been pretty steady.
60 at their peak.
Full-time equivalent staff members, and it's gone up one or two a year, and the budget's gone up a couple hundred thousand a year.
Including the administrators? Just the inspectors.
Yes.
I got you.
You know, but this has been an issue. Pennsylvania was taken to task by the Auditor General for that state in terms of not keeping up with the activity. I don't think we've really seen that in Michigan.
Greg, does the industry get inspected enough?
Well, in certain parts of it, we get inspected a lot. The 35, 36, whatever it is, full-time, year-round people, they're involved in the environmental impact assessments. They watch over the drilling and the completion phases of the wells. Once the wells are put on production and everything is set in place, there really isn't a lot of difficulty or a lot of problems later on. But the state does hire, in the summertime, they hire, I don't know how many, but quite a few summer interns, and one of their jobs is to go out and do a field inspection of every single well in the state. So every single well in the state gets visited by a knowledgeable person who fills out a 3-page checklist to make sure everything is the way it's supposed to be.
Is an intern good enough, James?
Well, if the state auditor general recently did a report, and we're supposed to look at every well, it's not happening. You know, there were some wells that weren't even visited during the drilling stage, and that is supposed to happen every single time. So we've got information out there that says some of these are slipping through the crack. I think that these high-volume hydraulic fractures need a lot more vigilance as far as being inspected, watching where they're getting the water from, is it being handled properly. I don't think we're ready, especially if the price was to shoot up. The activity would shoot up, and the question is, would we be ready? I think the answer would probably be no.
So I want to ask you one more question before we start asking for questions from you guys. Be thinking about your questions. Have we really had any major accidents in Michigan. I know through my reporting of only one well up near Kalkaska, which was alleged to have been damaged because of nearby hydraulic fracturing. Yes, a water well. The DEQ waivers on whether that was actually the case or not. At any rate, one well in 80 years of drilling, I mean, it's a well. The guy lost his water well, but that's pretty serious. Pardon me?
Benzie County?
So, what are we so concerned about? I mean, we've heard this horror story from other states, but what about, what's the problem in Michigan? Let's go the other way now.
Yeah, I would say the recent history has been very good, but if you go back that 80 years, we've got some major contaminated sites that are left over from really bad operations in the 40s and the 50s. Contaminated aquifers, I mean, really bad oil fields. So the more recent high-volume hydraulic fracturing has been relatively safe to this point.
I might point out that Michigan has a program called the Orphan Well Program, where wells that nobody can be found to be responsible anymore, they have, we believe, every single one of them has been identified. And over the last 10 years, a program has been in place where all of those problem wells with groundwater pollution or any other problems around them, they're being fixed. They're being cleaned up. So it's within the foreseeable future, probably another 5 or 6 years, we won't have any of those historical problem wells left.
Well,
it's going to take some time.
The wells have been plugged. The contaminated aquifers are still there, and they're going to be there for a long time.
I'd say, you know, from our study on this, we've, you know, you mentioned the landowners with the concerns about their water. There was another issue of concerns about hydrogen sulfide gas several years ago, not recently. There was also an issue of flowback fluid being used for dust control inappropriately. So we see a couple of items like that, but nothing like the kind of more extensive problems that have been identified in other states.
Now, I live in Lenawee County, which is down by Adrian, Tecumseh, and we've been seeing a lot more drilling in our area, and a lot of people are concerned about it. They're actually more concerned about the windmills they're going to build in Riga County, I'm not sure I quite understand that over the drilling. There's been more protest about the wind turbines than the drilling. So it's up to you guys. What's your question? Raise your hand. We've got a mic over here. You next. Yes. What's your question?
Comments.
Okay, there we go.
And first of all, I don't believe that this whole issue is about the actual drilling. It's everything that goes along with it. First of all, there's clear cutting of trees, and trees are the nature's way of keeping our water. Secondly, there is issues of when they do the well pad, there are trucks, lots of trucks, which makes for noise, which makes for the diesel fumes from the trucks, which hurts the roads.
Do you have a question for one of the panelists?
No, I don't. I have the question is that it's not all about drilling, is it?
No.
No.
I would agree with you. It's
about the quality of life.
There's a broad range of topics that people bring to this issue.
I'd like to mention, I think it's Maryland had a task force recently made a recommendation, which I think goes to this point, which says drill one well to see if you have a hit. But if you want to drill another well, let's say you have a hit and you think you're going to do a development, then the developer is required to do a resource development plan and work with the local unit of government on a lot of these infrastructure issues. I think that makes sense, in that then you decide, you know, which trees come out, where do the pipelines go, how do you manage this development as part of your community as opposed to having the developer dictate the terms?
I got two quotes that need. First of all, the Michigan Constitution, Article 4, Section 50, speaks to the public health and safety and welfare shall be primary. That's one law. The other law is the Administrative Procedures Act, which says the rights and privileges of the public, you should promulgate rules. Are any of those two subjects being applied to this situation as a whole?
Well, there are hearings often, but I'll let you experts address that. Who wants to go first? James, you deal with the administrators all the time in the legislature.
Well, there's an interesting case actually working its way through the courts right now, and it's the neighbor objected to a permit being issued, and the administrative law judge says, you know, no, you don't have standing.
Right, and local governments don't have standing.
And you don't
right?
have standing. In my mind, that's where the Administrative Procedures Act, if the next-door neighbor doesn't have standing to challenge a permit, who would? So I worry about, are the rights of the public being properly balanced against the right of the mineral right owner?
So a township supervisor, a mayor of a city, a county chair would not have the right to say, you can't drill here. This is purely left only to the state of Michigan.
Now, cities and villages over a certain percentage of population, they have some control over that also. Townships don't, but cities do.
Actually, they just had this in Adrian because they're drilling in the city limits of Adrian, and Adrian was against it. They still drilled.
They get noticed. They can't stop them from drilling.
All right, next question.
I think sometimes the fracking issue gets caught down, and we're trying to stop it. We're not trying to build alternatives to it.
A little closer. We can't hear you.
Okay. So as we're trying to oppose this and not build alternatives, I'm wondering where some of the alternatives like anaerobic digesters, which Michigan State's been working with the UN on in 2013, I believe it is a UN initiative for methane production from anaerobic digesters.
Actually,
Baby Food's been doing it in the state. The city of Ann Arbor does it at their landfill, as do landfills throughout the state. And somehow we need to promote the anaerobic digesters as an alternative. And I don't know if any of the anaerobic digesters or that methane production processing has been expanding in the state and if there's any promotion of that to sort of propose an alternative.
Actually, I've covered that issue. Anaerobic digesters have turned out to be one of the less efficient ways to recapture energy. I mean, I think there are a lot of ways we can recycle that waste. Anaerobic digesters have not proven to be a great source of energy.
I would note that especially when you're looking at natural gas, the city of Flint has a biogas off their wastewater treatment plant where they actually refine it, and it's pipeline-quality gas coming off of that system. So there's a number of systems that are looking at some alternatives. Now, Michigan, we produce about 18-20% of the natural gas we use, so it's not going to replace everything, but there are some alternatives that can start to be part of this pie.
And landfills and so forth, yes, I understand that. But, talk about these alternative energies.
Methane digesters usually aren't pipeline-quality. They usually are used to generate electricity, where wastewater treatment plants have enough gas where they actually turn it into pipeline quality gas.
We've got one over here. Yes.
This is a question for James Cliff. The nuclear power industry has a exemption from liability for a nuclear accident. I want you to tie in also the mining companies. There's a law 18 sometime passed that the mining companies have walked away from any environmental damage. Can you tie those concepts, the nuclear power, the mining, and how law may relate to people getting relief from damages to fracking?
So you got kind of two issues going here, and the question has to do with kind of liability concerns. Is the money there to take care of the problem? So first, we require bonds up front, either $20,000 a well or a $250,000 blanket bond. The Auditor General report recently pointed out that those bonding amounts when we've had to access them have not been enough. So I believe the state is about to start a discussion about raising some of those bond limits. The second question becomes, and this has happened more outside of Michigan than inside of Michigan, where there has been contamination, and then the landowners left trying to prove that it was a driller versus naturally occurring methane. That gets into a very expensive lawsuit. There's been some discussion of it using some tracers so that you would know if the chemicals were related to an oil and gas well, which would reduce the cost of establishing that liability, but those are not in widespread use. Although, if you look at the list of disclosed chemicals, it's interesting that some chemical companies are, some drillers are already using tracers. And the question is, are they using them to figure out where their drill went, or are they using them for liability protection in the future? But the tracers are one of the listed chemicals that are being used.
All right, James, I love you dearly, but I feel like you're dominating the conversation, so I'm going to throw a couple of questions to these guys. Greg, I want to ask you, you guys have been drilling for a long time. You've been using hydraulic fracturing for a long time. You've been using horizontal fracturing for a little while now. And suddenly, within the last probably 7 years, there's been a lot of heat because of what's happened in other states. What is your industry? What are people in your industry? Are they just freaking out because suddenly you've been quietly providing natural gas for them and oil, and now you're the center of attention? Is that a problem?
Well, it's obviously never fun to be the target, but I've been in the business for 40 years, and most of the issues that this lady just talked about have been issues with people, particularly neighbors in areas where wells are being drilled. These are not new issues. We've been dealing with them for a long time. The high-volume hydraulic fracturing issue really only became an issue, like he said, about 6 or 7 years ago because nobody ever did it. It didn't apply here. The idea of drilling the horizontal wells is to limit the surface activity so that you don't have, 15, 20, 25 well bores drilled, which means a lot more time and a lot more activity going on. Basically what you're trying to do is you're trying to replace a whole bunch of well bores with one. And that's why you have such high volumes of fluids being used, because you're replicating 15 or 20 different fracture treatments in one well bore.
Unfortunately, in Michigan, the horizontal drilling has not played very well so far.
No, I've drilled a number of horizontal wells over the years, and in the shallower stuff, like the Antrim, we gave up. It would cost far too much to do that, and we didn't recover enough additional gas to justify it.
Go ahead.
I'm just going to say this. The 18 wells that have been fracked with high-volume fracks are really, they're really experimental wells. It's in a new reservoir. It's in a reservoir that not very many people believe will be commercial. It's going to require much higher gas volumes than we have today. And so, I don't know where that's going to go in Michigan. I mean, I'd like to think it's going to become a very important tool, but so far it's not.
John, one of the journalists I've worked with whose full-time job is covering fracking in America is a guy named Abram Lustgarten with ProPublica. And he tells me one of the weakest parts of this whole concept, this whole industry, is there's not enough academic research. Why haven't we figured out some of these geological problems, some of the critical problems that come with this in a more in-depth way? Why aren't the universities, why aren't we seeing grants from the federal government paying for some of these studies to find out what we're really dealing with instead of just drilling in the dark?
Well, I'd say, oil and gas and engineering work that's gone along with that has been something that's been, going on for years. There are some new issues that are coming up in terms of people wondering about the connections between water quality and the fracturing fluids and seismic activity. There's just a whole range of things. With many of the issues, what makes it complicated is trying to understand, is there a way we can look at cumulative impacts? What are the interactions between different things? We send down a certain mix of chemicals and waters. That's a different mix when it comes back up because it's gone through some chemical interactions when it's, you know, down below. We've got faculty members looking at that right now trying to figure out what more can we understand about the chemistry of the fracturing fluid, of the flowback fluid. But there's, you know, there is a lot of work going on. I'd say, you know, as I've watched this, if you folks have looked at this over the past couple of years, it's just been phenomenal in terms of the amount of work that's going on. Some of it is being funded. There's a very large study in Colorado being funded by the National Science Foundation that's trying to take a very comprehensive look over several years, a whole range of community impacts, the ecological impacts, economic development issues. So it's a lot of this work is underway. It's every day it seems like there's another new study that we are coming across, either in terms of the impacts of fugitive methane emissions to water chemistry issues to real estate prices and proximity to oil and gas development. It's just every day. It's just hard to keep up with it sometimes.
You know, we talked about water use. We're going to take some more questions. We've got a bunch of questions going here. Let me just ask this real quickly. We talked about water use earlier. The anglers of the Asable have been talking about the concern about how much water is being taken out of the watershed. We talked about 1% of all the water used is actually used in drilling. How much do we put our watershed at risk when we're withdrawing that much water for wells in that area?
I think one of the things to note again about what we have in Michigan is we do have kind of a pretty unique approach to this in terms of a water withdrawal assessment program and a water withdrawal assessment tool, which does try to look at individual kind of watersheds and withdrawals that are taking place. Now, one of the challenges with that people in the state, the kind of advisory committee that's looking at that is, this was a tool that was developed, I believe, for more longer-term withdrawals, not for short-term withdrawals that are pretty much associated with hydraulic fracturing. And so it's, you know, one of the things we've worked on report.
Nestle's taken care of, but the drillers
Well, more like agriculture is really what it was developed for. All right. Know, long periods over long, you know, a large volume over a long period of time. One of the things we're working on with this report is what kind of changes should be made, could be made to this water withdrawal assessment tool to better, you know, assess and give us information on these withdrawals in terms of impacts and utilizing the framework that we've set up, but revising it to fit the activity that's going on, that it's being used for.
Greg, in one of these hydraulic fracturing, these horizontal hydraulic fracturing, how many gallons of water are we talking about and how many times, I mean, total? Because you have to do it a few times. Pipe pressurize that pipe a few times to make it work, or that borehole. So how much water altogether for, let's say, a half mile or a mile horizontal?
Well, there's no real limit on it, I mean, how much you'll use. I can tell you that the wells that have been done so far, the smallest one, I think, was about 2 million gallons of water. The largest one was 23 million gallons of water.
23 million gallons of water for one horizontal fractured well.
Right. The total amount of water used so far on the high-volume wells is about 126 million gallons, which is a huge number, but on a percentage of water used in the state on any given day, it's not a very big number.
126 million gallons of water that's contaminated and can't be used again unless we recycle it like John was talking about in other wells. What do you think of that, James Clift?
Yeah, I think what you need to look at is what you're looking at is that localized impact right when they're withdrawing it. So unfortunately, our shale formations are exactly where our world-class trout streams are. So you've got these feeder streams into world-class trout streams, and I think what we'll have to get to is monitoring those streams when we're doing that withdrawal to make sure that we're not impacting the wildlife and the fish resources that is the basis of our tourism industry.
Question back here.
While it's fair, I think, to mention that much of the water that goes into those wells is gone, it's also fair, isn't it, to say that this industry is the one that, while they use a lot of water, they also produce water. If you look at the amount of water created by burning the amount of natural gas this state burns, over 700 billion cubic feet, And for each billion cubic foot of gas burned, 11 million gallons of water are created. I think that's a fair point to enter into the discussion also, along with the fact that in the Osaba watershed, which is a pristine area with some of the best trout streams in the state and the country, there's currently 3,500 wells already drilled, already producing in that watershed as we speak.
Okay, that guy's got chemistry knowledge above mine, so I'm going to turn it over to you experts.
Well, I'd say, yes, there is the water budget that goes along with that, but where the gas is burned is not returning that water to where it was taken from. So that's the disconnect with that. I'm not going to argue with the equation, but that's the disconnect. And then I'd say, you know, the wells that are there, they're the shallower wells or the wells that have used much less water than we've seen in some of the wells that have the high volume directional wells that have taken place over the past couple of years.
Greg?
Well, I would, you know, if you look at where does the source of most of the water in the state of Michigan, in most places it comes from rainfall and or snowfall, and that rain and that snow comes from the atmosphere. So when you put all that water from the burned gas, it goes back into the atmosphere. So it might be a few hundred miles from where it was taken out of the ground, but it rains everywhere. And, you know, we get water from the Gulf of Mexico when we get a heavy snowstorm. Water moves around in the atmosphere pretty well all by itself. It doesn't have to go back in exactly the same spot to offset the use of the water in the, where it was taken out.
The problem is, how long does it take to replenish an aquifer if you pull from it? James.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure about issues and ales and chemistry. I'm not sure those three go together here, to tell you the truth.
Beer is all about chemistry.
And again, part of the equation was all of the natural gas we burn, 80% of which comes from outside the state. So, again, let's pass on that one.
All right, next question.
I actually have two questions. You mentioned earlier there was only one incident of possibly a well being contaminated. Is there an incident of some sort of seismic activity in Michigan? First question. The second, can you elaborate more on the disclosure of the chemicals put into the wells? For example, although it may be a trade secret, is the DEQ at least informed of those chemicals? And to what extent has there been a legal battle over the disclosure of that through FOIA or some other means?
Yeah, the second question is an excellent question. The first question was seismic activity. As a journalist, I can tell you there have been no news reports in Michigan about seismic activity regarding horizontal fracking. But that's not surprising because there are only these 18 wells.
But this other issue.
Yes. Yeah. The professor might disagree.
The seismic activity that has been seen in Arkansas, Texas, Ohio is not related to the fracturing process itself. It's related to the deep well injection. That's the connection. And in Michigan, we have a lot of deep well injection activity, but based on our geology, we have not seen any seismic activity. Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right. Now, I know there's been some changes in the Michigan law regulations recently, so I'm not really clear now about who gets to know what's in the fracking fluid and who doesn't.
Okay, I can answer that one. The operator of the well, that's the person who's drilling the well, doing all the work on it, must tell the supervisor of wells what chemicals were injected into that well bore.
When you say supervisor of wells, you mean
the state
with
of Michigan.
The DEQ.
The Michigan
Office
DEQ.
Of, wells.
Okay,
yeah.
There is a provision that if a company wants to keep their chemical formulation secret as a trade secret, there is federal and state law which allows them to do that. Now, that information must be provided to any medical people who are treating somebody who's been injured on a well or anything near there. So it's not 100% a trade secret, but in the general scope of things, they have to apply for and they have to do certain things to get that trade secret. That
James,
doesn't apply just to our business. It applies to all businesses.
James, let me give you a hypothetical.
Well, I think Greg just gave us a hypothetical, is that somebody comes into the emergency room, the chemical has been spilled on them, and they're told to call the supervisor of well to figure out what chemical they're supposed to be worried about?
Mine was something like that. If you've got a local town with a surface water reservoir that's their supply of water, and there's a spill of a truck or one of the tanks that holds this fracking fluid, I mean, what are they? How's the local guy supposed to know? Oh, I got to call the DEQ supervisor of wells.
Yeah,
I
mean, unfortunately, this isn't a hypothetical. This happened in Wyoming. The spill occurred. The people went into the emergency room. They had to evacuate the emergency room. And that's what led to Wyoming's disclosure law, is that this information needs to be available on the web at the time the chemicals are being used so that first responders can have it immediately.
What about these trade secrets? So these companies are building this fracking fluid. They want to make sure they keep their customers. They've got this special formula that's got, I don't know, it's got slippy slidey stuff in it. It really works. And is that, I mean,
in my mind, it has
on the
to,
other hand, on the other hand, you know, we're talking about proportions, right? And I was thinking about this earlier. I know what's in the Heinz ketchup because I can read the back of the label, and I know it's not going to hurt me much, but it's not under the FDA.
Yeah, again, I think you need to balance kind of the right of protecting the public versus the proprietary right of that trade secret. I say the public has the right to know what that is. If it's being used on public land or being used on your property, you should have the right to know what it is.
I would just say, kind of watching this over the past couple of years, the trend that I see is towards more and more disclosure in advance to a broader, you know, to the broader public.
But that's going to require action by the DEQ, if not the legislature.
Yes.
All right. Next question.
Just on that point, Lester, proposed rule would require disclosure 30 days after the drill in Michigan. That's the current proposed rule being considered by the department.
Say that again. I didn't catch it.
So disclosure 30 days after the drill is what's currently been proposed by the department in Michigan.
30 days is a long time.
So I have a question about climate change. Natural gas fracking process emits methane, which has 20 times the greenhouse gas emissions as coal. And my question is, given that fracking in natural gas is almost an equal to coal as an emission of greenhouse gases, what do you say to your kids and your grandkids about the work you're doing to promote natural gas and fracking when you know that it's undermining?
I want to make a distinction here, because you're talking about the actual release of methane into the air, which is a very, but we're talking about using natural gas, and I know there is some escape of natural gas in the process, but you're talking about natural gas as a fuel. Once it's burned, it's actually producing half the CO2 that coal does.
Yes, so, on emissions, it's emitting half the CO2. But the natural gas fracking process,
that leaks, right,
from
yes.
complete in the life cycle of the process, according to academic studies, is competitive with coal in terms of the aggregate greenhouse gas emissions
exactly.
to the atmosphere. So my question is, what do you say to your kids about that? Because the more natural gas that's introduced into the energy cycle, the more you're crowding out renewable sources like solar and wind. So what do you say to your kids?
Okay, so Greg, before you start, I just want to make a point. You know, there is a great reliance on fossil fuels. Too great for too long, in my opinion. I do think, though, that until we're able to find enough green energy, such as wind and solar, which has not been encouraged in this country as it has in other countries, we are in this point where we've got to find an interim step between coal and renewable energy. However, natural gas, burning natural gas, and the escaped methane that comes from these wells is having an impact on climate change, and that is going to cause, is causing, major problems in this world now and certainly for our children and grandchildren.
Well, first of all, let me address the escaped methane issue. I'm not going to deny that 30, 40 years ago, people didn't worry quite so much about venting of natural gas from their controls and that kind of thing. Today, it's very, very rare. So I think if you look at the academic studies, you'll see most of them are several years old, and there's been a major address of that issue across the entire industry in the country, and the amount of gas that's vented to the atmosphere today is actually quite small, very small. And as far as what I tell my kids and grandkids, I tell my kids and grandkids that I have been proud, proud to be a member of the oil and gas industry for my entire career. And I would do it again tomorrow. So I'm very happy with how it's turned out.
You know, I'd say there's a lot of different ways to look at this. Are we looking at the fugitive emissions from the drill site? Are we looking at the distribution system? Are we looking at how the fuel is used itself? Because it really depends on whether it's being used in power plants or whether it's being used for transportation. It's very different. So when you look at the models and the competing models that are out there, because there's a whole range in terms of how people are thinking about what the climate impact is going to be, you really have to stop and look at what are we looking at the whole system from production to use, or are we looking at one piece of it?
This is why I love working with academics, because the answer is always, well, it's more complicated than that.
Well,
Let me make it simple for you. So I'm going to do my little issues and ale prerogative here and say that this really isn't a big issue in Michigan. But in my mind, one of the biggest environmental crimes in the country is the flaring of natural gas. You know, in my mind, if someone is going to
Which is happening at a well near me. I got to tell you, bothers me every time I drive.
Not very long in Michigan. They pretty quick. Well, you've got sweet gas, so they're flaring hydrogen sulfide.
Okay.
That's what they're flaring.
You should be happy they're flaring.
I just learned something, yeah.
So in general in Michigan, if it's methane, pretty quickly we require them to put it in a pipeline. But if you look what's happening in North Dakota, and with low natural gas prices, we flare 25% of the natural gas we use in this country. The rule should be is if you're going to go after a fossil fuel, you're going to capture 100% of what
All
you
of it,
bring
yeah.
to the first surface.
Okay, next question.
Thank you. My question is the horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing industry still exempt from water use reporting? You had mentioned the water use assessment tool, and as long as they're not reporting their water use into WellLogic statewide groundwater database, how do you expect them to utilize the tool?
I believe the state is reporting on water used in completions. I would only add to that, one of the things we're talking about in our report is, as you mentioned, linking that to the decision-making tool.
Just to clarify, when did it become not exempt? Because as of 2011, it was exempt.
When you're saying it's exempt, are you referring to the federal rules or are you referring to some state rules? Because the state of Michigan requires reporting of all fluids recovered from all wells, and they've required the reporting of fluids injected into wells for a long, long time.
This is what I've been talking about.
Over 12,000 well logs into the database, and there was no water use reporting for the horizontal drilling. It was exempt.
It depends on what database you're talking about, because, again, as I mentioned earlier, Congress has barred the US EPA from looking into this at all. They are not able to regulate any of this, but anything to do with extraction of fossil fuels and water. So it's up to the states.
Here we go. This is, again, getting late in the night for this. They're exempt from using the tool under the statute. They're required to use the tool under the supervisor of well order. They're required to report how much water they withdrew under the supervisor of well order. Their well drill log does go into the WellLogic database. That is a recorded well log that is required to go into the WellLogic database.
I'm not following you on any of that. You're saying every bureaucratic level has a different desire and a different requirement.
So the law exempted them from using the tool because at the time
they were still... And when you say them, you're saying...
The oil and gas industry. Because at the time they were using 50, 80,000 gallons a well. 2-3 years later, all of a sudden it exponentially went over that 100,000 gallon level. So for a long time they didn't do anything. Recently, a 2011 supervisor of well order required that they use the tool and report exactly how much water they withdrew at that point.
Again, you mean DEQ?
DEQ. No, right. So exempt from the law, required through administrative order.
Does that answer your question? Where'd you go there? All right, let's have another question over here.
Can the panel just talk about drilling on public land in Michigan? What kind of lands are open to drilling and how many wells we have on public land?
Yeah, we touched on that a little bit earlier. John, do you have numbers on that?
I don't have any specific numbers, but there's an annual lease. It occurred last month. I believe 150 leases were...
Yeah, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head how many wells are on state land, how many leases are there. I can tell you that, again, it's highly regulated. It's regulated not only by the DEQ, but also by the Department of Natural Resources, everything that's done on state land.
This is what I do know. When the boom happened a few years ago, there were more leases taken by speculators from the DEQ than had ever been taken since 1929. Most of those were never followed up. Landmen were going to private owners and trying to make deals, and many of those fell through because nobody wanted to drill. And so there was this huge speculative boom about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, and we've not seen much of that on public or private land since, because these experimental hydraulic fracturing wells, these horizontal wells, really didn't play. Conventional wells on public land, there are a lot of them, yeah.
If you do Google Earth or Google Map and you look across the upper part of the Mitt and kind of zoom in around Gaylord, you'll see plenty of activity.
Yeah, there are maps on DEQ. I was looking at them today to show you where those wells are. And I got to tell you, on my honeymoon 5 years ago, my wife and I went up there around Gaylord, and we're driving around looking for moose and elk, and never saw either. But we saw a lot of drilling in that county. It's just amazing, just east of Gaylord, how much drilling there is around there. All right, next question.
Hi, I just wanted to ask about, we haven't really touched on like the political issues around sourcing our energy from the Middle East, say moving towards more U.S. located drills and wells.
One of the things that has happened, as I said, OPEC just decided that it would not decrease production, led by Saudi Arabia, and that was a long-term game they're playing in the Middle East. But part of the reason that Brent crude has gone from something in excess of $100 to something like $70 now, I think, $75. And our gasoline prices have gone from close to $4 to now $2.75.9, I saw today, which I found amazing, is because of the shale drilling of oil in the United States. And we've seen reports from the Department of Defense that say, you know, the less reliant we are in the Middle East on energy, the more secure we are as a nation. Now, in the last 15 years, there's been a huge transition. We import less oil now than we have in decades. And so your point of the political, I mean, we're still reliant on Middle East oil. And I don't know that that's going to stop until we find a way to be completely reliant on renewable oil. But there's been a big change politically.
It's been, for me, it's been one of the most amazing things about this, you know, studying this whole topic is for somebody who grew up in the 60s and 70s to think about the U.S. being energy independent, that's just, I can't fathom that really based on the history I experienced in the 70s. And it's, you know, the other issue, particularly for natural gas, is what would happen to activity in Michigan or across the state, or across the states, if we would start exporting natural gas, which we currently don't right now. That could be a huge game changer in terms of the level of activity we're seeing or prices.
Yeah, Michigan is one of the biggest of the states in America. Michigan happens to be one of the largest importers of energy, which is ironic since we have enough sun and enough wind that we could be exporters. There have been several studies shown just wind alone would allow us to be an energy exporter.
I would argue from some personal experience that depending on the sun to provide the power you need, even for small radio control systems, is not a good idea in Michigan. You don't get enough. You need huge battery banks to do it.
Okay, this is issued in ale. Here's the ale kicking in. Germany has less sunlight than we do, and they are...
I'm telling you from personal experience.
I'm glad. But the fact is, Germany gets less sunlight than we do, and they have more reliance on solar than we do. So, all right. James?
So I think the other factor that's in play here, and it gets downplayed a little bit, is that we're using less oil. And Michigan, we've been dropping at about a rate of about 1% a year. We've been reducing our use of oil.
And thank you, Ford, GM, and the rest of the auto industry for actually, I mean, not that they have a lot of choice.
Following federal law. but I think we could do a lot more of that, and you would see a lot of the same impact. If you want to keep these prices low, if we continue to focus on energy efficiency and using the energy we do drill for, we do create, I think we can go a long way toward keeping these prices lower and keeping the U.S. in an energy-independent mode going forward. I think, you know, you look into this exporting issue, I think you're not looking long-term enough. I mean, I think we should be looking long-term, slowing down our production a little bit to match our use, and because it's going to be gone one day. So the slower we use it, the better.
I just, not to pick on Greg, because I get your point, personal experience, but my friend Matt Grokoff in Ann Arbor owns the oldest house in North America that is a net zero house. He actually produced more energy this entire year. Last year, you know what the winter was like, right? He actually produced more energy with solar panels than he used for the year. So it's possible. All right, next question.
I guess my main question is there seems to be a lack of remediation technologies for either the water involved in the process of getting the natural gas or water aquifers that are contaminated in the processing of getting the natural gas. And if there are a lack of those technologies, shouldn't that responsibility be put onto the production of the natural gas, the producers? And then on a side note, if we aren't going to have any remediation technologies and everything gets put into our deep injection wells here in Michigan, how safe are those deep injection wells?
Okay, so I'm not going to answer the deep injection well, but at this point, there have been no contamination of aquifers in any way. We're talking about removing water from the aquifers, which are much more shallow than the wells they're talking about. So we're removing water from aquifers or surface water sources.
Outside Michigan, in other places in the country, there have been contamination of aquifers.
But it's
are there technologies even outside of Michigan being developed either in universities or private industry to remediate, number one, contaminated aquifers, and number two, remediate the pollution in the water that's used in the process?
All right, gotcha. Thanks for the clarification. John, you got an answer?
Hey, I'm not familiar with processes for remediating aquifers, but there's definitely, you know, like as I mentioned before, Pennsylvania and Texas do recycle a substantial amount of their water for reuse in the activity.
The fracking water. Fracking fluid, yes.
But the other point I wanted to make is there are a lot of new technologies being developed that would require less water or maybe no water. for the fracturing process. I think they're still cost prohibitive at this point, but that's stuff that people are looking at. Are there different things that we can do? Can we use gas? Can we use different things to complete the fractures and not utilize that much water?
Well, one of the things that we did in the shallow Antrim wells, we first started out using just water, but then technology was developed, I think by Amoco, in how to mix carbon dioxide, and then that later changed to nitrogen with that water, so that we ended up using about 20% as much water as the earlier wells did. The rest was nitrogen primarily.
I'm sorry, did you say 20% less or 20% of?
About 80% less. 20% of the water we were using, we used in the later fracture treatments. It's not practical right now at the depths that these horizontal drilled wells have been, because the gas stays a liquid at that temperature and pressure. It won't expand like it does at the shallower stuff. But people have been looking at it. It's not a simple nut to crack, basically.
Just I want to make a couple of points. It all gets into the value of water. In Texas, you know, at its peak, I think they were paying $1,500 an acre foot, about a third of a million gallons of water. So when you pay for water, you have a different view of it. In Michigan, it's free. If you contaminate an aquifer, the technology is there to clean it. And the one thing we've been actually exploring in Michigan is that we have up north a few contaminated aquifer from old manufacturing facilities. And we're asking the question, can we use the water from those contaminated plumes to do our fracking? And you know, we're starting to explore some different options.
Question.
I'm from Traverse City. The wells in Kalkaska are those deep, high-volume hydraulic fractured wells you've been talking about. I'm concerned about what happens after. The pipelines, the injection wells, where does that waste go? A person in northern Michigan that I respect highly told me that you don't have to force the wastewater down those injection wells because it goes somewhere. And he said also there were plumes in Lake Michigan that were warmer than the lake, down below the surface quite a ways, at about the same level as that shale.
Yeah,
I respect that, man. I want to know what you think.
Okay, so I'm not an academic, I'm not an engineer, and I'm not an environmentalist. But I am a journalist, and I can tell you that there's nothing getting into the Lake of Michigan, because this is far, far lower, deeper than Lake Michigan. What happens is... Okay, we can talk about that. I just want to talk about the hype. Most of these wells that we're talking about, the one that has caused so much concern, it's geologically so much deeper than the water sources or the lakes. In fact, in Canada, they drill under Lake Erie. They have tens of thousands of wells slant drilled into Lake Mary, or actually surface water, drilling below the bed of the lake to recover natural gas. So the injection wells are basically in Romulus, aren't they? They're nowhere near the...
There's... My understanding is that there's been no known contamination from deep well injection, but that's not an absolute, certain, forever answer.
Yeah, that's my understanding, is that as far as we know, nothing that we've put into the brine layer has come back to the surface yet.
So now, how many deep injection wells do we have? I know there are some around Romulus.
Thousands
around. Yeah. And so these are being basically injected into an area that was a pocket that was an old ocean, right? A prehistoric ocean.
Well, this might help, is that the brine layer is used by a number of industries in Michigan as kind of their sewer. So a number of industries pump waste into the brine layer.
And how far down is that?
2,000 to 7,000 feet. So it kind of depends where you are in the state.
And it depends on the geological formation, too, right? Yeah.
Although I had the same concerns about, you know, for forever we've been saying out of sight, out of mind, this is our generation's...
The solution is
injection wells. All right, next question.
How long before these experimental wells become real wells? Like, how many years does it take? Is the data being collected? And exactly what kind of data is being collected on the experimental wells to know, are the corrections being made along the way? Or is this, we're just waiting for the final...
When they say experimental, they mean, did they work and did we get gas? And I think, Greg, you probably...
You know, there's two definitions of success in the industry. One is finding the reservoir with hydrocarbons in it, and the most important one is getting your money back. Wells will take a long, long, long time at present prices to get their money back.
Yeah, they've not been financially successful.
So the key there is it's not a measure of time, it's a measure of price. So if the price of natural gas goes to $8, they will be here. They will be looking at our shale.
And I just want to clarify that they're not experimental in the sense that, you know, massive studies are being done on these. They're experimental, I'd say, more from a industry practice. What's the return on investment?
Let's get back out there. So what is being done in Michigan right now as far as, let's take the other way, the experimental. What data are you responsible for, the DEQ, or how do we know right now that these 18 wells are okay or that they're not okay?
Well, you probably didn't hear our little chatter here. It's the experimental part is it economically viable? So they look at how much they're getting for how much money they put into the well. They compare that to the price that they're getting for the product.
Nobody's,
that's the experiment that's going on.
Nobody is checking to see if this is safe or if it's
right. I come from a healthcare background, so yes, I'm thinking about human health from this. So is that
right.
being collected?
And one of the things the state is proposing is some additional monitoring of wells.
To me, that's way above any price it ever is or costs or we get back.
It's one thing the state is doing, and there are some other folks that are looking at the chemistry of the flowback fluid to better understand that.
You should not go into fossil fuel extraction because you'll go broke. I just and you're good with that, I think.
it's not a scientific experiment. It's a financial experiment. Let's be clear about that. It has nothing to do in any way, shape, or form with what the value of what's going on there is. The only thing it's got to do with is can we make some money?
Yeah, define value.
Wait a minute. When the first couple of wells were drilled, those companies said, we think there are oil and gas in those rocks, and we can get it out. They drilled the first two or three were, we need to see what's there. They knew the money they spent was gone. Once they found there was some oil and gas there, and they thought they could get it out, a few more wells were drilled to see if this is going to be a successful play. We call it a play when you drill a bunch of wells in the same type of reservoir. At 18 wells, the price for their product dropped low enough that nobody was willing to spend $10 or $12 million to drill another well.
Okay, folks, we are at the end of our time, but we have time for one more question. Make it a good one.
Yes, thank you. Yes, we're all familiar with the concept of peak oil. I was wondering if there was a similar concept for peak fracking. What is the end result of this whole process? How long can we expect to run this game out?
I mean, so maybe the best analogy there is if you look at Michigan and a lot of drilling for oil in the 1980s, and all wells, they have kind of this curve where very productive, they kind of hit a peak, then they go down. So on the oil plays, we're down to maybe half of the production that we were getting in the 1980s of those original wells. The Antrim now is on the down curve, part of that curve. So now they're trying to figure out, is there another curve for them to play? And it's interesting, the most productive county in Michigan for oil today Hillsdale County, because it's a relatively new oil play down in the Irish Hills area. So all of these are just kind of a curve. Now, with the fracking, the question is when you frack, are you changing the shape of that curve? Might you be getting a taller, steeper curve that drops off faster? Do the shales give it up at that same rate over a period of time? So when we talk about experimental wells, really you're looking at the technology used, the shape of that curve, and the price of oil or gas.
Anybody else? Okay, I want to thank my guests. That was James Clift with the Michigan Environmental Council. He's the policy director there. He is banging on legislators' doors all the time. We also heard from Greg Fogel. He's with Old Mission Energy, a petroleum engineer, and thank you very much. He's on advisory committees for the state in advising them. And we heard from John Calliwart. He's with the University of Michigan. Go Blue. Graham Sustainability Institute. Thanks for coming out and drinking with us.